you today. A little update. I believe that this week, actually, as opposed to last time, is the last week of Midrash in the Morning. And stay tuned, hopefully, on Thursday for an announcement of what will be coming next week. So we have this week, and we have today and Thursday as the last two meetings of this particular class. And I will hopefully have an update for you very soon about what will be coming next. Okay, we're about to get started. Okay, a little bit about what we're looking at today. The Midrash we're looking at today, again, we're still in Bamidbar Rabbah, and we're going to be looking at a piece from Bahalotcha today, is a discussion of what I would call the absurdity of worship. And I'll tell you a little bit about what I mean by that. There is a moment, I think, that every religious person experiences at some point where they ask a form of the question that the wicked son asks at the Seder. Right? At the Seder, the wicked son asks, "What is this worship to you?" Mahavodah hazot lechem. And I think there's a moment that each religious person asks about their worship of God. What could this worship possibly mean to God? And I'll unpack that a little bit. By which I mean, if God is almighty, if God is all-powerful, if God has no actual need of human beings, and again, we're going to pick apart that understanding of God in the Midrash, but that's our common understanding of God in the Western world, I would say. Then what am I doing by worshiping God? God does not need my worship. My worship has no effect on God. And is it actually arrogant for me to imagine that my worship has an effect on God? I'm curious, please use the chat if you've ever experienced that or if you have a particular moment of memory of experiencing that. I'm very curious if this is actually as common a phenomenon as I imagine. And our Midrash today is going to tap into that question of what are we doing when we worship God? What need, quote unquote, does God have of our worship? Oh, Arlene Berger answered, as a chaplain, I've had many people express this often at the end of life or in crisis. That's really interesting. Robert Niederman, yes, I do, but I don't believe in that God. He does need us. He is not all powerful. That's a Greek idea. It's not a Jewish idea. Great. And we're going to see that in the Midrash. Joe Hyman says, sacrifices feel like this to me. Why does God need a pleasant smell? Great. And today's Midrash is actually going to use the Mikdash as the center for that concern. And then Jeremy Rudeler says, certainly, especially with prayer, why would my requests influence God's plan? Amazing. So I'm really excited. I think that this Midrash is going to have a lot to say to us today. Okay, let's jump in. Our central psukim are from the beginning of Bahalotcha, this week's parsha, and they're going to surround the question of the lighting of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Specifically here, actually, the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Let's jump in. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you mount the lamps, let the seven lamps give light at the front of the lampstead. And I'm going to read this in the Hebrew. Daber al Aharon va'amrata elav bahalotcha et hanerot al mol pnei ha-menorah ya'iru shiv'at hanerot. Aaron did so. He mounted the lamps at the front of the lampstand as the Lord had commanded Moses. Here's where our Midrash is going to pick up. Our Midrash is going to note that something very interesting happens in these psukim, which is specifically that God is marking time in terms of a human action. We usually mark time in the Jewish calendar by astronomical phenomenon, by the sun, by the moon, things like that, or by our accounts of the months. Here, actually, God is saying, when X happens, here's what you should do. And the Midrash understands this as God is actually using a human action to determine time. Let's jump into the Midrash and see how that works. Line one. Another interpretation, at your setting up. This is what the verse says, Psalms 139:12. Darkness is not dark for you, your night is as light as day. Darkness and light are the same. And to us, he says, at your setting up. So here's what just happened. We have a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms. Gam choshech lo yachshich mimecha v'layla kayom ya'ir kachashecha ka'ora. That line is taken to mean, God, you actually have no need of light or of darkness. Day and night are the same for you. So A, why do you care if we're lighting the lights or not? You actually don't need the lights in any form. And B, you who have control over day and night, over darkness and light to begin with, are marking time by what we do. You're actually taking that into account. It's an absurdity. One note on the use of this psalm is that this Psalm 139 is often used in connection with creation. Let's take a look at the comment on the right so that you can see a little bit about the context for this verse. Where can I escape from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I descend to Sheol, you are there too. If I take wing with the dawn to come to rest on the western horizon, even there your hand will be guiding me. Your right hand will be holding me fast. If I say, surely darkness will conceal me, night will provide me with cover. Darkness is not dark for you. Night is as light as day. Darkness and light are the same. So there's a lot in this psalm that's actually about human futility, the futility of human action before God. And that's the setup for the question that the Midrash is about to engage in. So just to reiterate what we've done so far, we're engaging with this question of what does it mean that God is marking time in some way by our lighting of the menorah? Why does God even care if we light the menorah? God controls day and night, light and darkness. We see in this pasuk from Tehillim that darkness actually means nothing to God. And more broadly, how do we reckon as religious human beings with the fact that God actually, at least in our, and again, I'm going to go back to this Western conception of God, has no need of our actions? How do we actually conceive of what we're doing for God when we worship? Okay, line two in the Midrash. We're about to engage in a parable in a mashal. To what is the matter similar? To a king who had a loved one. The king says, know that I will eat with you, so go and prepare for me. The king is going to come to this person's house for a feast, and he's given him advance notice, which is very kind of him. Go and make sure that you have everything ready. The loved one went and prepared an ordinary couch, an ordinary lamp, an ordinary table. And specifically, just pay attention, the word lamp here is obviously menorah, which is going to be the explicit parallel to the Mishkan. When the king came, he brought his assistants around him and a golden lamp before him. When the loved one saw all the glory of the king, he became ashamed and hid all that he had prepared for the king since they were all ordinary. I want to really take a moment to appreciate the emotion here, shame. Shame at the coming of the king, shame at anything that we can provide compared to what the king already comes with. And I'm curious, I don't know if I've ever experienced that particular emotion when it comes to worship, even if I've experienced the question of what does God need with my worship? I'm curious if anyone in this class actually has ever experienced that feeling of shame of what can I provide before God that the Midrash is describing here. Just a moment to note before we go on that there's something that is actually a little counterintuitive happening here. We have just experienced paragraphs upon paragraphs of description of how ornate the decorations in the Mishkan are, how elaborate they are, how just actually special they are. And what we're being reminded of in this moment in the Midrash is that those are nothing compared to the glory of God. When compared to what God is coming with, that is your. I'm actually sitting right now, this moment, on the hand-me-down sofa that I have from the time when my husband was single. We refer to it as the bachelor couch. The bachelor couch is essentially in this midrash. What the equivalent of the kelim, the instruments of the Mishkan, would be before God. I'm going to check the chat before we go on. Elisa Hurwitz says, aren't there pieces in the Shemoneh Esrei about shame and asking God to help us through the shame slash shield us from our shame? That's a really interesting point. Yes, that's really beautiful and very on point. Robert Niederman, I feel shame when I cannot live up to the spirit, the kavanah that the prayer requires of me. Great. So I just want to note that what both Robert and Elisa did there is actually do what we as rabbinic Jews do. They're taking this paradigm that applies to the Mishkan, that applies to, in this midrash at least, temple worship, acknowledging that our worship is actually prayer, and then talking about what is the adequacy or the inadequacy of that form of worship before God. Francine Shaga, shame can be connected to feelings of inadequacy and futility. Very much so. Let's jump back to the Midrash for a moment. So, where we are right now is the loved one who the king is coming to dine with has actually hidden everything that they prepared because they're so ashamed of the inadequacy of what they can provide before what the king already comes with. The king said to him, "Did I not tell you that I would eat with you? Why have you prepared nothing for me?" So the king walks into the friend's house. Nothing is prepared. There's no food, nothing on the table. Did my invitation get lost in the mail? Did you somehow mix up the date? What's going on here? The loved one said to him, "I saw all the glory that you came with and was ashamed and hid all I had prepared for you, for they were all ordinary things." And here's the moment of vulnerability. Here's the moment of this relationship is actually being taken to the next level by acknowledging the shame, by acknowledging the sense of inadequacy. Here's the moment, if we jump out of the mashal, out of the parable for a moment, where I think we're actually being told that impulse, that feeling of inadequacy that so many of us identified with, that feeling of shame before at our own human limitations. This can actually be a moment of transformation in relationship with God. This can actually be a moment where there can be a new honesty in the relationship with God. I'm going to just check the chat for a moment. Nancy Kaplan, this parable refers to the king's loved one rather than to the king's son. Isn't this unusual? Is it significant? Great point. I have most often seen that done specifically when the Midrash is talking about God's relationship with one of the patriarchs, most often Abraham. But I think you're absolutely right that it's a less common form than one of the king's relatives. Paula Drill, when I'm vulnerable in my prayers, but know that God has other far greater issues to deal with, I identify with that very much. Robert Niederman, this is like Adam when he hides from God. I think that that's a fascinating comment because the chapter of Tehillim, the chapter of Psalms that we saw at the beginning, is also used midrashically to describe that scenario. When the midrash is talking about wherever I hide, you can find me. That's also used for a jumping off point for that. And here, instead of the shame being used to hide and cut off relationship with God, as I think often happens in the telling of that story, it's actually being used to bring our relationship with God to a further point. God says, "You are enough in all your limitations to us, loved." And that, I think, is the thing that we most hope for in our relationship with God. And honestly, I think that we most hope for in our intimate relationships with other people and our close relationships with other people. Let's jump back into the Midrash. We're now at line six. The beloved friend has just admitted how inadequate they feel before God, and God is about to reply. The king said to him, "By your life," which is a way midrashically of saying, "I swear, that I will ruin all my things that I brought with me, and for the sake of your love, I will not use anything except your possessions. I don't care about all these glorious things. I am willing to break each and every one of them. I am willing to throw them out." And here I think there's a little play going on in the context of the Midrash. Darkness and light mean nothing to me. I think that the Midrash is picking up on that and saying, that's because God makes a choice. God makes a choice to say that these amazing things, day and night, that God brought with God's self, actually have no meaning because God wants to specifically tap into what the beloved friend can provide as a way not of benefiting from the things, but benefiting from the relationship, meaning this is a way of showing love, of saying, I am going to specifically tap into what you are providing with me. And so the Holy Blessed One is entirely light, as it says, and light dwells with him. And God says to Israel, prepare for me a menorah and lights. I love this image of God as entirely light. Let's look at that in context of Daniel. Daniel spoke up and said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever for wisdom and power of his. He changes times and seasons. Again, this issue of time, God is able to control time, removes kings and installs kings. He gives the wise their wisdom and knowledge to those who know him. He reveals deep and hidden things, knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. And I think there's something beautiful happening here in Daniel, that he reveals deep and hidden things at this point in the Midrash. We now understand that that not only means that God knows all, it doesn't only mean that God is omnipotent and omniscient, it doesn't only mean that darkness means nothing to God. It means that God knows our fear. It means that God knows our feeling of impotence, God knows our feelings of inadequacy. And yet that is not a barrier, that is actually something that can be used to help in relationship with God. Why is it written there in Exodus, and they will make me a mikdash and I will dwell in their midst, vasuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, and make me a menorah of pure gold? So when you make it, the Shechina comes. Take this seriously. Vasuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, and you shall make me a menorah. The Midrash is saying God actually makes a decision to dwell there. God makes a decision to dwell among the work of human hands, not because they are so beautiful, not because they are so amazing, not because you've made them in some way that appeals to the divine spirit, but because you made them. Why is it written there and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting? So we're looking at two verses here. One from Shemot and one from Bamidbar. At the end of Shemot, where God comes and dwells in the Mishkan, we're told that the Mishkan actually is so filled with God's glory that at first Moshe is not able to enter. Whereas in Bamidbar, we have this verse, when Moshe went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he would hear the voice speaking. So the Midrash is playing these two verses against each other. What does it mean both for God's glory to be so filled there that Moshe can't enter, and yet we have this other verse where Moshe goes in and God is speaking to him? It says here, what would it speak to him? And let's just read that in the Hebrew for a moment. Ma diber elav, what would it speak to him? What would it say to him at your setting up of the lights? So the Midrash is cueing in on this verse, at your setting up of the lights, as the key to understanding what I think is the paradox of the Mishkan. On the one hand, God's glory would overfill any place that we could construct. God's glory cannot be contained. If we were to imagine that God's glory could be in a place, it would be impossible for us to permeate. And yet, on the other hand, we have this very intimate vision of Moshe going into the Mishkan and hearing what God has to say there. And the Mishkan is, and the Midrash is asking, how can we make sense of these two together? You know how you do that? With this verse, with our understanding of this verse at your setting up of the lights. This is the key. God makes a decision. And I think Francine Shraga used this word in the chat a little while back to actually say, I limit myself. I submit myself at this point. I make myself smaller in some way in order to be in relationship with you. And the way that I've marked that is by this verse, at your setting up of the lights. I acknowledge that that actually now is part of how I mark time and it has meaning to me. Let's take a moment and go to the chat. And as I share some things from the chat, I'm really curious about, at this point in the Midrash, what are you feeling? When you really take into account that way of describing the Mishkan, of describing what happens there, what does it make you feel? And how does it compare to your feeling of the Mishkan when you generally read it in the Torah? Meaning, when you generally read about the Mishkan in the Torah, in the Pshat, on Shabbat, what feeling does that elicit? How does it compare to the feeling that you have at this point in the Midrash? Let's see what's happened in the chat. Melinda Zama, a lesson to us to remember that the material things mean much less than our relationships. Yes, and so hard, I think, to remember specifically when it comes to worship. Sarah Bonberger, a deep God experience can generate a profound existential shame about humanity's inadequacies. So on the ball. And what I love about this Midrash is how it uses that as a tool. Joe Hyman, I'm not sure I understand the significance of what happens when we light the candles. Great. So part of what the Midrash, I think, was doing was saying, when God says, when you light the candles, that is a way of God saying, that is a marker in time. I have taken that into account as a way of marking time. And the Midrash is dealing with the absurdity of that and using that as a jumping in point to talk about how God actually is limiting God's self to what we can provide in order to be in relationship with us. Nancy Kaplan, I think it's empowering. Like when we are given control over our calendar, which you shall declare, very much so. Robert Niederman, when I read about the Mishkan, it has always seemed strange. I identify with that very much. And part of what I love here is it makes it into something very similar to my own home. Paula Drill, powerful promise of our partnership with God, we must light. And the emotional response is hope and optimism. The call to light in these dark and difficult times. Amen, amen. Judith Stone, feeling of being loved, that God seeks out relationship with us. Nani Vonnegut speaks to me of the relationship God wishes to have with us. Robert Niederman, when I light candles, I do feel the presence of the Shekhinah. That's my favorite at-home mitzvah, by the way. That's been so much more important to me than ever since lockdown began. Elizabeth Legat, building menorah is an opportunity and a tool for us to reach out to God. Sarah Bomberger reminds me of the joy of a parent at a child's simple drawing. We recently in my parents' home discovered that they still have a little ceramic thing that I made when I was three. It's hideous and I love that they kept it through the years. Let's just read these last few and then we're going to close up. Arlene Berger, the daily lighting ritual shows how to move something from mundane to holy, like our relationship with world and God. I love that. Joe Hyman, a feeling of being enough with what we give. Exactly. And a feeling of being enough, not because we have somehow measured up, but because we trust that we are loved, which is so important to this Midrash. Melinda Zama, The lamps and all that goes into the Mishkan has always seemed extraordinarily beautiful, like nothing we can recreate. But the Midrash compares them to ordinary lamps, etc., changing worship to God from something unreachable in our times to now within our reach. We bring whatever we have, and it is beautiful to God. I love that. And Philip Dixon just gave us the perfect place to close off. I think God chooses our songs of praise, chooses to accept. And that's really what the Midrash, I think, is saying is at the core of our relationship with God. And what I think is also a way of understanding our relationships in general. Relationships in general, I think, are being under... I think in the model presented here don't happen because you have somehow measured up, because you have somehow finally been good enough. They happen because people choose to accept you in all your inadequacies, in what you can provide, because you are beautiful to them, not necessarily what you do. And I find that model particularly beautiful, and I hope meaningful for you also. Okay, we're going to close out here. As always, if you have comments, reactions to what we did this morning, feel free to email me at adler@hadar.org. I have been slow at answering email over the last few weeks. Please do not think that that means that I don't care. I really appreciate emails and I'm hoping to catch up very quickly this week. All right, everyone, have a great day, and it's great to see your faces and names on the screen as always.